but so Jenny Levy was, or is, the women, she's the national team lacrosse coach, but she's also the UNC women's coach. She's been to, I think, 9 out of the last 11 Final Fours, won a couple national championships, but she got the head coaching job at UNC when she was like 24 or 25 years old. And she was a really good player, All-American player, and she got the job. And, you know, they had success right away, if you define success as did you win, right? And they went to some quarterfinals and NCAA tournaments. And she's like, but it was miserable. Like, my team hated me. I hated them. They all hated each other. She's like, I couldn't sleep at night. It didn't feel right. You know, she's like, you know, we just worked so hard and we were so fit that, you know, we could overcome people, and because that's what I was all about. And then, you know, she talks about meeting with Roy Williams, the basketball coach there, and two coaches at UNC, Anson Dorrance, a women's soccer coach who's won 22 national titles, who created this great, incredible competitive environment, yet this super strong family with UNC women's soccer. She's like, that's what I want. I want it to look and feel like that. And then she talked to Roy Williams, the basketball coach, and he had just won his second national title. And she just said, you know, how do I get over the top? We're close, but we can't, you know, win those final two games. We can't get over the top. And he said something to her. He said, you know, Jenny, you have to know what it's supposed to feel like, right? To be part of your team, to show up and be a part of this. And you have to be 100% in line with, this is back to like the Steve Kerr, like it's gotta feel good to you. And you might never win, and you have to be okay with that, right? And what she realized in that moment, well, first she was like, oh, that's easy for you to say, you won two national titles, right? But she's like, you know, in that moment, like it really hit me, like it doesn't feel good right now. I don't like this. I don't like this environment. Players don't feel good about being part of this program. And so that, like, Roy Williams kind of gave her permission to make it feel a different way. And it gave her permission to be like, you know what? I might never win a national title, but I want to be able to sleep at night. I want these players 20 years from now to be like, I'm so glad I played for Coach Levy. I'm so happy I played at UNC. And since that moment, she's won two national titles, and like I said, been to 9 of the last 11 Final Fours or something like that, right? So all of a sudden, by doing something which some people might point to as, oh, that's not competitive, caring about what people feel like, creating more compassion and love and family, they've become more competitive. They've become the juggernaut program.
So one of the most misunderstood aspects of transformational coaching is people think that when we start to care more about relationships than we do the results, that it requires us to give up caring about results altogether. It's not an either or thing. You just heard a story from John O'Sullivan. He's back this week to discuss some important principles around creating an experience that feels right for us and for our players, and how to do that in a way where we detach ourselves from the results but not give up on them. We have to redefine success for us as a coach. If you're struggling with this internal conflict around results and relationships, this is going to be a great episode for you. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin alongside my co-host Nate Sanderson. And every week in 30 minutes or less, we're giving you transformational leadership tools and strategies. This podcast is brought to you by Thrive On Challenge, which provides mentorship for coaches to help them grow as a coach and build their culture. You can learn more at thriveonchallenge.com. You're listening to episode 118, Become More Successful by Creating an Experience That Feels Right, with our guest, John O'Sullivan. All right, so now I kind of want to jump into part three of the book where you really start to focus on how does it feel to be coached by me, I think is part three's title. But you know, for me, that really stuck out about that part three was the importance of building relationships with each person. Now, you talk in the book a little bit about the North Carolina women's lacrosse coach, I think Coach Levy, a little bit there, and her struggles to make the big final push to win an actual national championship. And mm-hmm. I think there was a quote there. I hope I get it right, but she said, "I made a huge mistake early on thinking that every player thought and acted like me. But I soon realized there was a huge difference between how I thought and acted and how my team acted. And I think this is where we really struggle as coaches, especially because I think you mentioned earlier, like with Steve Kerr, about, you know, being the starter and then not being the starter, and he's able to empathize. I think a lot of us as coaches were the guy. Like, we were the person on our team. We were the starter. We were a big role player. And I think for a lot of us, I know myself, I always struggled to empathize with what it was like to be on the end of the bench there. I didn't have a whole lot of experience. And I always talk with coaches around this idea of, we don't need to just put ourselves in their shoes, but we need to put ourselves in their feet. Because I'll explain that. I always felt like, man, if I had their opportunities, or if I had the shooting machines that kids have today, if I had all those things, I would have done, you know, I would be in the gym all the time. But that's not the world they live in. That's not the things that they've experienced. And I think Levy kind of recognized that. It took me a long time to recognize that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that story, Jenny Levy's story, is one of my favorites. And, you know, when I wrote the book, like I did not write it in order. I started with, just to get myself going, I started with, well, what are my sort of favorite stories? What are my favorite things that I like to share? And so I think that was the first or second thing I wrote. The reason I share Anson Doran stories and Steve Kerr stories and Jenny Levy stories and, you know, Cindy Timshel, the winningest lacrosse coach, and Nancy Stevens, the winningest field hockey coach, you know, throughout this book, is because I think a lot of the things that we talk about when we talk about transformational coaching, the non-engaged coaches, the people who haven't changed in 30 years, they dismiss these things as non-competitive, but yet they are a competitive advantage, right? When you create the right feeling, when you coach the right way, when you treat your players with respect, when you create an environment of love and family. And so it's very easy to dismiss these things as, that's not coaching right there. It's not tough. But yet, you know what? There's, you know, 2 World Cups and well over 100 NCAA championships in that book, and state titles of, you know, high school coaches and youth coaches that say, no, actually, this is a competitive advantage right here. So sometimes we have to use winning as evidence that this stuff works. And I tried to weave those things together in the book.
And I think the funny thing about that response from people is that in just about every other aspect of life, when we feel better about ourselves, we're going to perform better. You know, when I feel better about myself, I'm a better father, I'm a better husband, I'm certainly a better coach, you know, and that's the leverage that we used when we started at Linmar, was, you know, this idea of getting them to describe their favorite teammates that they've played with, but really to bridge that to how did it feel to play with them, you know, because when you feel better about yourself and about your teammates and you feel like they have confidence in you and you belong, like, you're going to perform better in that place. And I think what you're describing here is just coaches being intentional about trying to build an environment where that can happen every day to bring out whatever potential each player has.
Definitely. And I mean, there's, you know, I have a whole chapter on, like, the mental game. You know, you know, to win the outer game, you got to win the inner game. And I love this. Tim Galway, great writer, you know, decades ago wrote this book called The Inner Game of Tennis, and he has this thing called the performance equation, right? Performance equals potential minus interference. So how you perform is your potential, which is, you know, your hours of practice and all your preparation and your sleep and your eating, and your genetics, can't get around pesky genetics, right? Minus interference. And the single greatest thing that interferes with performance is between your ears, right? And so when you create an environment on your team that strips away that interference, right? Potential is your ceiling, and interference lowers the bar. And so as coaches, if we create environments that strip away as much interference as possible, whether that be from the way that we coach, to parents interfering, to how teammates treat each other and interact with each other, the more interference we strip away, the closer we get to our potential. And I think it's just an interesting way to look at coaching and look at creating your team environment. And you're exactly right, Nate. Like, if I act like the best teammate I ever had, and if all my teammates do the same, we're stripping away a lot of the interference, especially, I mean, you coach, you know, girls sports where, you know, young women, that dynamic in competitive sports can really tear a team down if you're not intentional about consistently building that family and that closeness.
I just want to come back real quick to one thing you said a little earlier too, John, which was, you know, why you put so many successful winning coaches and their stories in here, because I think those were really powerful. But I also just want to let listeners know that it's not just winning coaches at high levels. John, you do a phenomenal job of touching on youth coaches and youth administrators and, you know, recreational, you know, coaches and athletic directors, and just tying those stories in, because yes, there's the Anson Dorrances and these transformational coaches, the John Woodens that have seen the success out there. And there's been a big part of that has been that style. But there's also coaches that don't succeed all the time and don't win. And I mean, you see that even right now with Steve Kerr. I mean, they're the bottom of the Western Conference because they got a bunch of guys injured, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it's a perfect example if you want to look at Steve Kerr right now with the Warriors, right? Or if you want to look at, you know, the World Cup this summer where him and Greg Popovich, you know, finished sixth or whatever it was, right? Like, talent matters, right? You have to have at some level, you know, there's physical talent. And if you don't have it on the day, and the Warriors obviously no Steph Curry, no Klay Thompson, no Kevin Durant, you know, no Andre Iguodala, like the team's very different. Right. And so all of a sudden, I mean, take any NBA team and take away their top three guys from last year, and they're going to be at the bottom of the conference, too. Right. So it is what it is. And these are things. But does that all of a sudden, is Steve Kerr not a great coach? Like, of course, he's still a great coach. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's just sometimes these are the way things go. And this is why I think, especially on the educational level, youth sports, high school sports, collegiate sports, right, where it's sport for development and you're tied to an academic institution, like, we have to do better than only evaluating coaches on did you win, right? We have to have a higher purpose than that. We have to attach that educational mission and those educational values to the sporting thing. And so many athletic departments out there, the way that the coaches treat the kids or the way that they go about their things, like, they're the antithesis of what happens during the school day. And I think that's really, really sad. Like, what's the point of, you know, Joe Erman said this to me, you know, what's the point of having school sports if the values and the things being taught are completely detached from what happens at school? And I think it's just a really great point to ponder.
Yeah, I use that argument a lot when I see a lot of coaches try to justify their behavior when it comes to yelling, and that's how kids respond. That's how we get them to do that. And I'm like, that's not the real world. That's not even what the world they go into right now when they go back to the classroom. You know, teachers don't have, they can't use those type of motivational tactics to get the kids to turn their homework in. You know, I think, I mean,
you
just
can raise your
down.
Voice. You can raise your voice, but you can't do it all day, every day.
Yeah.
Right. It can be a pattern interrupt, right? That boom, you know, snaps people back into, well, yeah, I got to get this going. And teachers do that too, right? So I think these are the things that I think in a school, coaches should be under the same standards of behavior as the teachers are. And I think what I really try to do in the book is present enough research that says, you know, besides these stories, that, hey, look, the research says this is actually more effective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I take your guys' opinion on this, but, you know, it seems like every time a coach who coaches in this positive, close family environment, like a Pete Carroll, Sean McVay, Steve Kerr, Brad Stevens, right? Whenever they do well, it's like, well, they got a lot of talent. When the team struggles, they say, oh, well, you know, he's too easy on them, right? Or she's too easy on them. But when we have a coach who's, you know, coaches in an abusive, over-the-top, demeaning way, and they struggle, no one ever says, well, it's because they treat their players poorly. They usually say, well, those players just aren't tough enough. So we have this real big problem in coaching that when you treat people with love and respect and empower them and try to make them better, and you don't win, people look at your coaching style as the reason for that. But when you treat disrespect people and demean them and bully them, and you don't win, we tend to blame the players. It's not tough enough. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it's actually really encouraging, just as some of the stuff's coming out, even like at the NHL level, that they've seen to have some teams and organizations have seemed to have drawn a line in the sand there as far as the way that coaches or people in an organization are treating some of the players, you know?
And again, you know, I think this is really important. You know, in the Culture Code, Dan Coyle talks about, you know, how tough Greg Popovich is, right? And I think his assistant coach, and I quote him in the book, says, you know, he'll tell you the truth and he'll love you to death. So we always have to be careful as coaches when we see a Greg Popovich getting in a player's face. What we're seeing is 1% of the interaction. And if the other 99% behind the scenes is love and respect and attachment, which is what Greg Popovich is all about, then that 1% happens and the player goes, yeah, you know what? I needed that in that moment. But if we only just act like that 1% clip that we saw on ESPN, we don't know how Greg Popovich coaches. We don't know how Steve Kerr coaches. So until you sit in on practice and watch them interact all day long with their players, don't model on you know, ESPN plays of the day, because that is a really poor model.
Yeah, that's like modeling my parenting in the most stressful moments in our house. You know, there are some serious breakdowns there. If they put the film on me there, that would be a really bad example of parenting.
Exactly. And again, you know, it doesn't mean that great coaches don't screw up. I mean, that vulnerability piece is one of the most important pieces. And so screw up, mess up, tidy up, just like we tell our players to do, right? If you mess up, that's okay. You know, apologize. Seek the player out and say, you know what, I didn't say that in the right way today. It didn't come out the right way. I mean, usually anything that you've done that might be somewhat damaging to that player's confidence, if you come over to them and grab them and pull them aside, or, you know, send them a note later on or an email, or put a note in their locker that says, you know what, I wasn't a very good coach for you yesterday because I said this way and it came out wrong, and I just want to apologize. Because I appreciate how hard you work, and I know you're working hard for the team. It's gone. It's done. And they're probably even closer to you and will play better for you because you tidied up than if you mess up and then you go, well, you know what? It's weakness if I admit that I was wrong. Like, it's just wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think it comes back to, this ties in really nicely with our last part here of your book, where you really talk about kind of really redefining success, you know, and you kind of touched on it a few minutes ago when we were talking about, you know, the Steve Kerrs winning and then they're not winning and people's judgment of them. And you really make a really good case for redefining success beyond the wins and how we should view that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think, again, great coaches, great teams have a higher purpose than winning. And when you do have that higher purpose and you're, you know, you're outcome aware, but you're driven by your purpose and you're driven by the daily process of getting better, you're going to win more often than you're going to lose, right? Given equal talent. and so when I talk about redefining success, it's really, okay, well, what do we have to look at that goes beyond winning that says this has been successful for me? And I think, number one, if we're in the sport for development space, we are growing our sport, right? So we want kids to come back next year. Number two, we're coaching the future coaches, right? So we are modeling coaching behavior, because when they start coaching, they're going to coach like they were coached. And they're going to coach like their favorite, most influential coach. So what are they going to coach like? It was really cool. Right before we got on here, I got a text from a former player of mine. She's 25, 26. She's teaching. She just got her first coaching job, coaching a JV high school girls soccer team. And, you know, she reached out to me like a month and a half ago and like, oh, my God, I'm coaching. You know, how should we do this? And she just sent me a text this morning saying, you know what, I just want to say thank you. I'm having so much fun. And you know what, you were just such a great coach for me. And I hope I can be the same for these kids. Like, so my influence on that one kid is now on to 20 kids this year. And if she keeps coaching for the next 25 years, how many hundreds and hundreds of kids, thousands of kids, is she going to influence because of what I modeled for her. Was I her perfect coach? No. But I probably did more good than bad. And so I think recognizing that we are also creating this coaching tree. And it doesn't mean, you know, my coaching tree doesn't have to be Bill Parcells' coaching tree, you know, on the NFL level, but it's a coaching tree on youth sports that I think is far more impactful in terms of the amount of people that it can influence, you know. And so that's what I mean by redefining success, looking at your own health and well-being as well. We can get stressed. We can lose sight of our time with our own kids and our own families, our own spouses as coaches. And so that ability to take that step back. You know, I did a whole chapter in the book, not in that section, on coaching your own kid. Right. And like, you know, something like 80-90% of coaches coach their own child at some point. So, you know, how do you go about doing that? Right. You don't ever learn that in a coaching course, like how to coach your own kid. Right. But like, how do you take off coaching hat and just be mom or be dad again? And, you know, how do you preserve that relationship with the human beings that are your children rather than ruining it over, you know, being their coach and driving them to some, you know, short-lived sporting success? So I just think, again, people have to know, how do I define success at the end of this year? That's huge.
Yeah, one of the stories that I really enjoyed in that last part was your piece about, you know, it's 2001, I believe, and you're in San Antonio, and there's two coaches in the front. You want to tell that story real quick? Because that's really one of my biggest things as far as how I define success is just being a lifetime learner and loving that process.
Exactly. And that's definitely one of the things, right? The New Zealand All Blacks in rugby say, you know, when you get to the top, change everything, right? And so, you know, I was probably 28, 29. I was at my first coaching certification. I was coaching college soccer. I thought, you know, big ego, look at me, look how important I am. I remember sitting in this room, and it was like a sports psychology lecture or something. And I'm sure I was sitting in the back and, you know, not necessarily ready to take notes, kind of have my feet up, you know, I need to learn more drills. Why are we sitting in here? Why are we talking about psychology? Kicking my feet up. And, you know, I remember looking to the front row and two legendary coaches, Anson Dorrance, from North Carolina women's soccer. I mean, the guy had won a World Cup, won, you know, at that point, you know, 15 or so national titles. And then the guy, Ellis Inman, who was, you know, a legendary college soccer coach, went on to coach in Major League Soccer as well, also incredibly successful. They were sitting in the front. They were asking questions. They were taking notes. And kind of it hit me in this moment of like, wow, the people who I only hope to someday be as successful as a coach are sitting in the front asking questions, taking notes, and I'm sitting in the back because I think I know everything. Maybe I don't. and so they, you know, good on those two guys to model them. And when I had Anson on the podcast, I told him that story. And of course, you know what? He didn't remember it. He has no idea that happened in my life. He didn't know who I was. But, you know, your influence is never neutral. And there you go.
Well, John, just why don't you tell us a little bit more about where people can find your book? I mean, just kind of the basic overview of the book was what I thought was really, really well done. As far as you have really engaging stories, and you don't just stop with some great principles, but there's some really, you go in depth in the strategies and then some practical applications at the end of every chapter for coaches. So I know a lot of the coaches really appreciate that format, even just on how we try to do our podcast here. So I know they're going to really appreciate your book for sure.
Yeah, sure. So the book is called Every Moment Matters, How the World's Best Coaches Inspire Their Athletes and Build Championship Teams. You have a worldwide audience. So Amazon is probably the first place to go and find it. You know, you will be able to request it from your library or your Barnes & Noble or places like that will have it as well. It comes out in, you know, around December 10th, 2019. So, hopefully in time for to order it and get it by the holidays for sure. A perfect stocking stuffer for the coaches in your life. Or you could just come to changingthegameproject.com and, get yourself a signed copy directly from me if you want. And then, I finish every chapter with sort of activities, because I think that's what brings it home. Right. And so if we, you know, talk about building core values and culture, here's a couple activities to do that. You know, you want to identify your cultural architects versus your cultural assassins. Here are some activities to do that. You know, here's some things to think about coaching your own kid. Here's some things to think about the difference between coaching boys and coaching girls. That's a whole chapter. So there's all these different activities there, and actually, you know, there's a whole chapter on, you know, engaging and working with your parents instead of dealing with them. And the story is Nate's story in a blog that he wrote for Breakthrough Basketball, and that we had in our podcast or on our website, and he talked about in our podcast, which I just think is a great story about how do you make parents part of your culture. And one of the activities is, you know, five great questions that Nate asks his parents that, you know, I've started doing with mine. And you know, how are you guys going to support what we're building and doing here? And so every chapter has activities that as a coach you can do with your athletes or with your teams or with your, you know, parents to implement these things. And I wrote the book in a way that, you know, you can read the whole thing through, but then you can also dive back into parts, right? So there's supposed to be multiple points of entry where you can go into, hey, I need to create a better learning environment. What might that look like? What are some activities I can do to really recognize, you know, am I creating an effective practice? Or, you know, revisit my coaching purpose, revisit my team's purpose, revisit our values, things like that. So lots of multiple points of entry. So you don't have to read the whole thing at once every time. Mm-hmm. And then lots of activities so that you can make these things real. And you know, I just have to say this, you know, in the beginning, I just talk about, you know, just find your 10%. Right. This is not throw out everything and start again. If you're listening to this podcast, you're already probably doing so much right. You're probably doing a great job as a coach, but find 10%, something you can layer on, one more tool for your toolbox. Implement that, remove something that might be less effective. And then once that's established, go find another 10%. And that's how you evolve, not by, you know, dumping everything in the trash, but just, you know, switching out something that's good for something that could be better. And if you keep finding 10% and growing as a coach, your teams and your athletes are going to get better and appreciate you for it.
Absolutely. I know that I've been reading on the PDF form, and I'm going to be buying it on Kindle and going back and rereading it, because there was so much that I took from it, and that I was already sharing some of the stuff from it with other coaches. I was like, this is just gold, right? So many spots. So I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
And JP, I'll promise all your coaching listeners as well, because I've already been asked, like, as soon as I sent it out to my email list, they're like, when's the audiobook coming out? Well, sometime in 2020.
Okay.
when I get my voice back and I can record it. But there will be an audio version as well. So anyway.
Well, thanks so much for coming to the podcast, John.
Yeah, guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
Now, just a reminder, I said this last week, but if you buy John's book, Every Moment Matters, email me the receipt at jpnurbin@thriveonchallenge.com. I will send you one of the following three systems. You just let me know. You can get the Competitive Cauldron System, the Talent Assessment System, or the Coaching Journal System. These include PDFs and Excel files. If you buy Every Moment Matters and Calling Up together, I'll send you all three systems. These systems with these two books, I think, are an incredible way to start 2020.